Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and you're listening to episode 107 on nomenclature. So what's in a name and what format should it take? And is there anything that you can't name a species? In the first part of this two-part episode, we discuss the purpose of the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature and the code that it produces. And in the second part, we'll start looking at how the code applies to the fossil record and trace fossils in particular. And from you, our audience, we want to know what your favourite names are. Are you a fan of classically named species such as Tyrannosaurus rex? Or do you prefer something a bit more special like Draco rex Hogwartsia? Let us know on social media. And as always, we've got pictures to accompany this episode on our website, and likes, shares, and reviews on iTunes and social media will always be appreciated. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Marcus. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Okay. Hi, Dave.
Okay, we like to start off pretty much every episode by asking our interviewee, what was their route into paleontology?
Well, mine was actually via mineralogy. While staying at the island of Elba in Tuscany in Italy, at the age of 13, I saw so numerous other tourists run around with hammers and chisels and pick all those beautiful pyrite and hematite samples from the open cast mines there. And this is how I got into stones in general. And a few weeks later, back home in Wuppertal in North Rhine-Westphalia, which is in the Vriscan orogene, we spent almost every weekend in the surrounding outcrops there. Major roads were being built those days, and there was either mineral or fossil to collect. And we kind of divided the work, or I divided the work with my parents. They did the fossils and I did the minerals initially. And when it came to decide upon what to do after school, I found that my math performance was way too ill, so that ruled out mineralogy. And I took the subject closest by, which was geology. And I was pretty sure that within geology, I wanted to be a paleontologist. And so I started studying geology / paleontology in Münster, where I'm still based now. And I found my decision the right one all the way through the study time and afterwards. I'm perfectly happy to have done it this way.
That's fantastic that you had your parents supporting you and being interested in paleontology themselves. Did they maintain that interest throughout your career?
Not throughout my career, but at some stage, while we are still doing the thing together, they said, Anna, you're getting too good for us. Don't you want to do the fossils as well? Which I did.
Cool. And what would you be doing if you weren't a paleontologist?
Well, I consider myself a paleoecologist mainly. And if I wouldn't be a paleontologist, I would probably do the same thing in the recent, which means something like nature conservancy. And I'm especially fond of reef, so I should be in reef protection and reef conservancy somehow.
Okay, but your work isn't actually on reefs, is it, though? You're an ichnologist, aren't you?
Yes, I'm an ichnologist, and this is how I got to reefs, basically, because my PhD was on Jurassic reefs in northern Germany, and as you can imagine, of course, there were plenty of borings in all the corals. And the borings are trace fossils, and naming them led me down the path to ichnology. And there I found my niche.
All right. Because most people, when you think about trace fossils, would go straight to footprints, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes, of course. Sure. I can tell you there are plenty of students starting here who have footprints of dinosaurs, especially, in mind when I think about paleontology. Yes, so the general assumption about ichnology only considers a small part of it, what it really is.
Yeah, but we're not even going to be focusing entirely on ichnology. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, sure.
The purpose of this interview is to get to grips with taxonomy and nomenclature. So let's start right at the basics, at the very start. So when was the system of biological nomenclature devised, and by who?
Well, it was a winding path. It started off with the Frenchman Gaspard Bouhon back in 20s, I think. He was the one to condense the many polynomials that were previously used to describe mainly living organisms.
So, a polynomial, would that be an animal or any other organism that's got lots of different names for the same thing?
Yes, it like a name that implies, in Latin, of course, bird, brown, small, long-legged. And if you transfer that into Latin, you have like four or five items that make up the whole name, which is a bit awkward to handle, of course, and that was realized before, but Bouhon was the one who took the major step to call an organism by just two names, and so he was the one to introduce binomia, that is two names to call a species. And his system and many of his genera have actually then been adopted by Carl Linné, or Carolus Linnaeus, as he published, the Swedish researcher. And it was 1753 that he published his Species Plantarum, which means species of plants. So that is the start of binomial nomenclature for botany, and he did the same thing for zoology in 1758, which he then called Systema Naturae, the system of nature. And that is the start in 2 different years for botany and zoology, when actually the binomial nomenclature took off.
Did he try and name every single species on the planet that at least he knew of?
Yes, I think so, because Systema Naturae is very widespread and covers all kind of organism or kind of phyla and classes at considerably different depth. There are many mammals, there are many birds that had been named by Linné already, but as you can imagine, very few tapeworms or something. Huh? And insects, the insect diversity is enormous, and Linné, and we still, with all the nomenclature power that is existing on this planet, have only perhaps gone half the way to name everything.
Yeah. So what purpose does nomenclature serve? Why are we so bothered about what we call different animals or organisms?
Well, I think the main purpose is to have labels that are short, unambiguous, and unique, and at the same time easy to remember, at best via meaning something, by conveying some meaning within the name, at least to the ones that are familiar with Latin or Greek. That was the original combination. So you're trying to serve many masters with taxonomy and nomenclature as well, yeah.
So it seems like a perhaps an added stage of complication. So if we use dog, for example, we already have the word for dog in is one word. It's one syllable effectively in most languages. And yeah, it's different in each language, but it's still very simple and easy to translate. Dog, hunt, shen, all of that. So why do we need this extra name when so many different names already exist for animals already?
Well, the main point is that you have to be familiar with many languages to comprehend what other researchers mean. And if we concentrate on one language, and it has been Latin that has been chosen by Linné, and from there on it has always been Latin or something that sounded like Latin. So that is a historical compromise, if you want to call it that way, that everybody has to have a bit of understanding of Latin, even the people, the colleagues that are not using the Latin alphabet.
And the last bit of context before we get into some of the details of the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature is what's the difference between nomenclature and taxonomy?
Basically, nomenclature is the law and taxonomy is the science. Nomenclature is fixed and it governs all the names in dubious cases, and taxonomy is changing a lot depending on what researchers currently think should be the base for a name. You know that species change their genus, or species are split into other species. That's all taxonomy, and nomenclature then governs what the outcome should be called. So that's a different thing. And that's why we have rules of nomenclature. We have a system that is rather fixed. And taxonomy is very broad and open to changes.
And so is that what the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature actually does, write those guidelines and enforce them?
Well, the idea is to give rules for the universality and unanimity and uniqueness of names, and perhaps more important, to warrant stability of these names. So each taxon, that is a species, a genus, or a family, should be, or the name of each taxon should be understood in the same way universally. That is the aim of the IZZN.
And why does it not apply to algae, fungi, plants, any other kinds of animals? Any other kinds of organisms? Why is it just animals?
Simply because the other organisms have their own codes. There's a code of botany, and there's a code of fungi and algae and other plants, of course, and there is a code of microorganisms. So all organisms have their own codes suiting their special needs.
Is there the potential to have a unified code for all of life, or is it just not as simple to apply something at one of the set codes to something else?
Yes, these ideas are fluctuating through the scientific world for a couple of decades now, I think. But it seems that the historical background of all the researchers concerned with it are stronger than the will to really unify the nomenclatural system. But in the end, I mean, it is critical even within the zoo code that I can only speak of. I'm not an expert in botanical or microorganismal nomenclature. starting to turn a screw at some end means perhaps a cascade of effects that you do not oversee at first, and you have to be very careful with all the changes. So I can well imagine that people who started off with a good heart and strong power trying to unify the system, in the end got frustrated. So it should certainly be done at some stage, but certainly not an easy task.
Oh, I could imagine. It'd be harder than even what Linnaeus had to do.
Definitely, because times have got more complicated since the 18th century.
Okay, well, thank God we got the ICZN to help us out. So what kinds of rules does it govern? What does it say that we have to do when naming an organism?
You could perhaps divide all those rules, the many dozens of rules, into four groups. One group is that the code sets the criteria for the availability and the validity of names. That is, it tells you what you should do when you publish, and it tells you what means previously existing name to your name, like the principle of priority. That is one group, or the availability and validity of names. And the second group is the identification of the authorship of names, which may be quite complicated if somebody as a sub-author publish within a book that somebody else edited, or somebody who has only given a name in passing by. Is that still a perfect establishment of that name? All these questions are addressed in this bit. And the third one is a very important one, especially for us paleontologists, the identification of name-bearing types. That system is a major part, and it's still being extended. And as a fourth section, you could perhaps name the treatment of dubious cases, which is spread throughout all these three other groupings. It's not identified as a section in the code, but you can find rules for these dubious cases throughout.
And are the guides enforceable in any way? Do you have an ICZN prison that you can throw unruly academics into?
That would be great sometimes, but not really. It depends on the universal acceptance of the code by zoologists. And the ones who deliberately do not accept it are free to do so, and they may cause as much chaos as they want. But it is up to the fellow and subsequent researchers to clear up after them. That is, say, no, this is not an available taxon, this is not a valid taxon, because it does not consider this and this and this part of the code. So the post world will neglect such works that do not enforce or that do not comply with the code. It's not us who can do that.
I think that answers one of the questions that we had in from one of our listeners, which was about arbitration and in a science that's filled with arguments, how does the code get enforced, if it even does? So that was from Kyle Freeman. Are there instances in which certain countries or academic groups or organizations will not adhere to the code or completely disregard it?
Not to my knowledge. But if the point is, if you publish names, you normally want them to be accepted. And you know that you only get them accepted if you comply with the code. So there is a kind of a peer pressure, if you like, to follow the code as strictly as possible. And there are some colleagues that do not, and who want to be a bit unscientific or so, and express this in the names that they establish. That's sometimes funny and sometimes annoying, sometimes both, but that is the freedom you have as a taxonomist to, when you set up new names. But you do not really have the freedom in disregarding older names, for instance. That is fairly set in stone by the code.
Okay, so with new names, I have just found a beautiful fossil, and I'm going to call it Dave Marshall is the best. Mm-hmm. Why not? Is there anything against naming a fossil after myself, or not really adhering to the rules? Would I be allowed to call it that?
Yes, you can call a fossil after yourself. You can even call it Dave Marshall without a Latin ending or whatever you usually find it, to it. But I have never come across such an example because it is too obviously selfish, I think. What has been done and is still being done, that a colleague, a friend of yours, names the fossil after you, and you in turn name a fossil after him. So in the end, both are satisfied, both have come up with names, with taxa named after them. You do not really do it on your own for yourself, but others do this for you. So it's tit for tat business.
Yeah, I've actually come across that. I've published one paleontological paper, really, as first author. And one of the things that I did was synonymize two species that had been named. One researcher named it after the other. The other researcher named his one after the first. But it turned out that they were actually part and counterpart fossils.
Oh, great.
Described decades apart. They were the same fossil.
Same individual even, amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, it does happen. No one's named a species after me yet, though, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But, on the subject of naming after celebrities, such as myself, is that allowed? Because it really bothers me. I really don't like the celebrity tie-ins and just how cheesy that is. Is it discouraged, or is the ICZN completely passive about it?
No, it's not discouraged, and the ICZN is passive about it, because you can coin a name, or you can jumble together letters and declare this a name. It doesn't even have to be pronounceable in our languages. We had a discussion recently within the ICZN whether we shouldn't install prohibitive rules on pronounceability, or whether we should define what is a name in nomenclature, because we have seen some examples recently where the abbreviations consisting only of consonants have been the basis for a species name. And the only thing that has happened is adding an I at the end to as a Latin genitive. And if you have five consonants without a vowel in it, you could hardly pronounce that. So that is... But these names are valid, they are available, and they have to be used, unless somebody finds out that the base, that is the individual that these names are based on, belongs to another species that hopefully has been named before. Then these names fall into oblivion again, because there are later synonyms. Now, for instance, we had a recent example talking about paleontology. In last year, listeners might know the German former punk, now just mainstream rock band, Die Toten Hosen. And the Toten Hosen are very popular in Latin America. And an Argentinian team of paleontologists named a bivalve after them, so it doesn't even have an I at the end. It is the genus is Die Toten Hosen, which is far off if you ask me, but it's a correctly coined name. It is standing, and unless some specialist in this case pectinate bivalves comes along and says, this is nonsense, this does not deserve genus rank, go back into some other genus and the species is okay, but it's not a new genus. Then as long as that doesn't happen, it stands. So it is, if you ask me, and if I may add on this, there's the longer tradition is that biologists honor each other, as we have mentioned before, and I think this is in a way okay to some extent at least. But as I say, the more annoying things are names that are based on abbreviations or just arbitrary combinations.
Yeah, the arbitrary combinations is an interesting one, because could we use a code instead? So like stars are named with numbers and letters. Could we use like a unique identifier for animals?
Yes, it is possible in the long run, I think. But I'm not sure, and colleagues are not sure where to draw the line between individual and species, because the problem is you can hardly identify an individual, no matter whether fossil or recent, and as a result, you use that code if you identify it. When you have a system of numbers or letters in that system only, we are fortunate that we have a hierarchical system now, which gives us the opportunity to refrain to the next higher level if we cannot identify it at the lower level. For instance, if you can't tell the species but you are sure about the genus, you just identify that fossil or whatever organism it is at the generic level and omit the species level. I can imagine that this would not be possible in a non-hierarchical system, like just based on letters or combinations of letters and numbers.
Okay.
Apart from the fact that names that convey some meaning are much easier to remember, and you all know that you easily misdial on a phone, or you forget your PIN for your bank account because you switch the numbers around. So I think with the names that are readable and pronounceable, we still have some advantage on the other possibilities that in principle exist.
So the last naming question I have is it possible to sell the name of a species to someone with a lot of money, to a backer or a sponsor of your research?
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, it is possible. And again, it's a question of scientific moral, whether it is done or not. You could do that because you're absolutely free to name an organism after whatever comes to your mind. If you have your reasons for it, you can go ahead. As long as you stick to the code, that name stands.
Right. Well, it sounds pretty much like you can name a species after anything. Is there anything that is prohibited? Which is a question that we got in from Brandon Brady. So if it was had lots of profanity in it, or if it was named after a dictator or anyone like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there's no way to prohibit that. If you mention the dictators, I recall that two species are named after Hitler, for instance. We have the species name Hitleri in the zoological history. One is a cave-dwelling beetle somewhere in former Yugoslavia, I think, and the other one is a carboniferous insect. So even paleontologists were not always free of Nazi thoughts and expressed it this way. And there had been an application to the commission to declare these names unavailable, but pointing to the non-violation of any existing rules, this application has been rejected by the commission that was in charge in the, I think, 1960s or so. So we have two Hitleri species, for instance. But, I mean, there are other names that are dubious, I'd say. We have the I think he was German-based ichnologist, who was into wasps, and one of those wasps he has called Aha with a genus name and Ha as the species name. So that wasp is Aha Ha. Or another name he coined, the genus I spell it out is Pison, and the species name is EU. So if you pronounce that, you can understand that it is not a species name, not a taxon name that you could mention at the coffee table with your grandma. So that is not prohibited either. Strange things. Even a colleague of myself in the current commission, Neil Even, he is... made some funny names within the genus Pieza, that could be pronounced as Pisa, and he has coined species names of pie, for instance. So there is Pisa pie, and he has made a species that spells Rhea, so that is Pizzeria. And he has also made a species that spells K-A-K-E, so it is pizza cake. So that is funny, actually, and then it's still pronounceable. So these are, within the realm of the code, and nobody would complain about it, but one could perhaps ask whether that is still with the necessary scientific seriousness. But I like to make fun myself, so I'm a friend of puns. thumbs up for all the pizza species by Neil Evenes.
I really dislike silly names for animals, but also, I'm a big fan of puns, and I was just sat there laughing at them. So clearly, I'm conflicted about all of this.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But in general, I hope that this episode isn't going to convince everyone to go out there and get inventive with species, because I really like the classically named ones and the ones that sound more poetic and stuff like that.
Yes.
But There's a place for puns, and I hope that that's not in nomenclature as much as it could be.
But, I follow you there.
So, fully with you. What kind of services do the ICZN provide? So do you have a list of all of the animals that have ever been named if we wanted to go through and look for puns?
Not yet, but there is the list of available names, LANs, that is being set up, has only started. The first LAN has officially been put in effect. But we have zoobank.org as the official register, and we have official lists only for opinions in dubious cases. But currently, there is no register, no database where you could check whether a species name already exists that you want to give to a genus, or whether a genus name already exists in the zoological world.
So hang on a second. You've got the list of available names, but you don't have a list of the names that are already named. So how do you have a list of everything that you could name an animal?
Yes, because the ultimate goal is to go through the process of establishing lists of available names for all the systematic groups. In the end, after some decades, we will also have that for all the arthropods and all the birds. I don't know, whatever you can figure out there. At some status, of course, there is a date fixed to it. That means that this is the official list of available names until, say, 2000, a year of 2000. And, of course, things can be added later on. But still, those names that are added later are not within that LAN, not in that list of available names. So you still have to do that research on your own. But usually, I mean, we have strong search engines nowadays, but I think that is rather easy if you have an idea what you should call a genus. The most of those search engines will find it. And you can tell, okay, I have to think about something else.
So turning our attention now to the fossil record, are modern and fossil animals governed by the same rules? You mentioned before about type specimens. Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs. And follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network.